Hello, and welcome back to the Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buda. Today we are continuing our coverage of Gene Wolfe's novella, The Eye Flash Miracles. Today is our second recap episode, and if you're reading along, this will take us up to page 299 in the story that's collected in, or the version of the novella that's collected in The Island of Dr. Death and Other Stories.
Yeah, don't forget that second Other Stories there.
You can't forget it.
No. Well, before we get into talking about this part of the story, I want to take a second here at the top of the show to let listeners know about, well, something I am really excited about that we are doing, or really that I am doing on Patreon, which is a series going through all of George R.R. Martin's Thousand World stories. You and I actually have covered one of them here on the Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that. I mean, a lifetime ago is really what it feels
really
like.
Really
a lifetime. But that was the first one that we did. And then you and I covered another one over on Elder Sign, the real masterpiece, Sand Kings. And that just made me feel like I wish we had time to do an entire show on that. We do not. But I am doing a very slow burn of a series on them on Patreon. I'll do about two of them a year. This month, I have done now the second installment in that series on the story With Morning Comes Mistfall, which is a environmental science fiction or ecological science fiction story. It's really the kind of thing that Gene Wolfe also has written some of, and it's, you know, contemporary to this period of Wolfe that we are covering now. Really feels like you can envision Gene Wolfe and George R. R. Martin, drinking some scotch at a con and talking about ecological science fiction together. Just a really marvelous masterpiece of a story. So I wanted to let people know that that project is happening. And, you know, if you're with us on Patreon already, you've got that now. But if you're not with us on Patreon and that's something that interests you, please come check us out.
This is a fantastic series, and I'm really glad you're doing this, Glenn. And boy, we could just expand ever outwards with the topics we're interested in between Patreon, Elder Sign, Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast, film show, which you know is ongoing or will be ongoing, and I like what we've built here. I guess that's what I'm saying. I'm glad we're doing these projects and have an outlet to talk about stories that we love and that interest us, and to bring people along on that. So I really recommend people check us out on Patreon if you haven't already, and especially check out this George R. R. Martin series. Turns out George R. R. Martin was a really big deal even before Game of Thrones, and I think it's worth putting that into perspective, especially as he keeps on getting guff for not finishing Game of Thrones. He's written a lot of words and a lot of great words in a lot of settings, and it's worth keeping that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that Game of Thrones is really, you know, where his long-lasting impact and fame is going to come from, but he was a better writer before he started writing epic fantasy, for sure. And, maybe that's for another podcast, because that's a contentious gauntlet I just threw down. Let's talk about the Eye Flash Miracles instead.
Yeah, well, we left our characters off, Mr. Parker, Nitty, and Tib, boarding a train illegally as hobos. And we did a lot of prefatory material in the last episode. We still haven't really gotten to a plot, so to speak, yet. So hopefully we'll get there today as we see what sort of obstacles are in the way of Mr. Parker, Nitty, and Little Tib as they try to, well, either get to Sugarland via Martinsburg or just Martinsburg itself.
Right. We're on a train now, and our three characters hop onto a boxcar, and they just really hope that the railroad police do not find them. Mr. Parker goes to sleep, but Little Tib and Nitty sit with their feet dangling off, just enjoying the ride. I just have to admit, this is something that I have always wanted to do, and so I really just love this part of the narrative, really just for the romance of it. But there's also some tender character development here as Wolfe shows Nitty really caring for and really caring about Little Tib, also for and about Mr. Parker, I should say, as well. And although Little Tib and Nitty are talking here and showing us this tenderness, it's really, you know, this conversation is really here to give us some more background information that we need. And some of it is about Mr. Parker. Some of it is about Little Tib. Let's start with Little Tib here. So Little Tib has encountered the police before, but when they scan his eyes, they cannot identify him. And so they just let him go because they don't have any procedures for dealing with someone who isn't in the system at all. And we learned that the scanners are retinal scanners. I mean, we knew that already, right? But here, Wolf has Nitti give us a little lesson on the anatomy of eyes so that we understand that the retina is a part of the eye and so on. And it seems that little Tib simply doesn't have retinas. So now let's talk about Mr. Parker. First, Nitti describes him as crazy and dangerous and also prone to some kind of fit, but it's kind of a loving description, even, you know, with that vocabulary, it's still kind of a loving description. And the reason Mr. Parker is like this is that he has some circuitry in his brain to make him a better employee. It gives him extra remembering and extra arithmetic, and it also makes him want to work longer hours and be more meticulous about that work. And when he lost his job, this was removed, and that seems to have caused a kind of personality disorder, maybe even some kind of delusion.
Yeah, that's right. And we'll jump into all of this, business with Mr. Parker and his situation. But before we do that, I want to sweep up some things that we maybe left scattered about from the pages we covered in our last episode. The first thing I want to talk about is a sentence about little Tib hearing a rooster crowing. Now, given that this narrative has evoked Jesus a couple of times already, attention being called to the crowing of a rooster cannot be ignored, I think. And for those who may be unfamiliar with New Testament lore, Jesus tells Peter, one his core disciple, upon whom the church will be built, that before the rooster crows in the morning after Jesus' crucifixion, Peter will have denied Jesus three times. So maybe in the story, a rooster really did crow in the background and Wolf is just observing what he's been given from the muses. Or it's a kind of elusive foreshadowing where we'll have Nitti or Mr. Parker maybe deny someone before the end of the story. Tough to say at this point, but it's something to keep an eye on. The next bit of business is from just after this moment where Mr. Parker explains the train situation to little Tib. And what interests me here is, at least by my reading, Parker's description of technological progressivism. And we see this when Mr. Parker says, quote, "When I was a young man, everyone thought the trains would be gone soon. They never said what would replace them, however." And he then goes on to describe that what the trains really needed was, maybe a little technological updating, but primarily they needed to conform to an aesthetic that would signify progress to the public. And I just want to point this out here, but I think as we continue with this story, as we move towards the discussion, we need to consider the ways in which the Eye Flash Miracles is in part a critique of how optimism is always associated or baggage of the ideology tied to technological progressivism. But let's talk about the pages we're covering today. I have to echo your sentiment here, Glenn, about the romance of trains and hoboing. Several Christmases ago, my father-in-law was really deep into the YouTube rabbit hole of hoboing, and it's like it's a real scene. It's like still really around today. But what struck me, that Christmas sitting and watching YouTube videos about people hopping trains, what struck me most about how it works now is that finding the empty boxcar is a thing of the past. Trains don't even really have boxcars anymore. They have shipping containers that fit onto the beds, of the train. And the other cars that aren't shipping containers aren't really places you can shelter in. So you have to find a car with like a crevice right in front of it and dress it very warmly and kind of crouch down and hold on. And like, this is a change that's, worth being cognizant of, because even if you go back at movies like Midnight Run from 1988, it's 35 years ago, lean on the imagery of the boxcar as a means of last resort of fugitive travel. But this sort of possibility is absent from our culture today. I don't think even I don't think trains are even in movies anymore, which is crazy to me. Probably because they're hard to like anime. I guess there's one in Tenet, but Tenet is a film that uses a lot of real locations and so on. But I don't know. To return to the text here, I do think Wolf has his finger on the pulse of how, given the way big business has infiltrated the government, he's got his finger on the way that so-called transhumanist improvements to ourselves would be handled. You know, that is in a classic cyberpunk fashion. Corporations charge rents for all their wares, and so nothing can be owned. So if you work for a corporation or even a school system, you are giving your body and mental functioning wholly over to that organization. And leaving means losing some of the function gained by working for them. You know, and if you replace like, you know, transhumanist brain upgrades for healthcare, like you have the system we live under today, basically. So, I mean, considering Parker's predicament, we'd expect him to be a little more critical of the system that displaced him and his job and stole his mind from him. But he's instead a little bit defensive of it. Like it seems at this point that Mr. Parker feels a personal injustice at losing his job, but he doesn't feel maybe that the whole system is unjust because he says that the retinal identification system is unsurpassed. You know, I don't know. On that note, though, every time this retinal ID system is talked about, Little Tib is silent or shuts down. And I think this is an early period in Wolf using this technique, which he then uses throughout the rest of his career, which is to get an illusion about the world from within the world. Maybe that's that's illusion. Apostrophe is referring to something outside the text. But having the characters shut down or ignore it or action interrupt exposition, this is maybe the first time Wolf's really using this to great effect, you know, in this story.
If this were a YA story, right, exactly what would be happening here would be that this trio of characters are going to break this unjust system. But because this is a story written by a middle-aged person for other middle-aged people,
yeah,
it is about just trying to get yourself back in the system when you've been gotten out. Because what you want is your stable middle-aged, middle-class life back. You don't want to break the system and change things. You just want your comfort and your security and your stability back. It's a much more realistic type of story, and I think a much more human type of story. You know, it's not rooted in the, you know, teenage angst and big feelings and so on. It's a real difference here. I want to talk about trains just a little bit. We're going to have a lot to say about trains in the discussion, but one thing I will say about trains at this time is that they are going away. Passenger trains are going away in the 1970s. It seems like this is something that Wolf is actually kind of upset about and has on his mind. So we'll take that up in the discussion for sure. But I want to just point out that just coincidentally, 2 weeks ago, Brent and I recorded an episode for Hanging Out with the Dream King, our Neil Gaiman podcast, about Neil Gaiman's story Trollbridge, which begins with exactly this sort of complaint, a complaint about the disappearance of the passenger train network around the United Kingdom. And so, I don't know, there's a lot of trains going on for me in the last few weeks with this story and with Trollbridge. Also, I'm just constantly reading about trains because my son Finch loves trains. My four-year-old Finch loves trains. And to that end, and I don't know that you have seen this on the schedule yet, Brandon, because it is for the schedule, After Your Life Changes Again a Lot in a Big Way, and there's no reason for you to have looked at that half of the schedule yet. But you and I are going to cover the Polar Express as one of our Christmas episodes on Patreon.
What a delight. So there'll be a what lot a nice more, surprise.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be a lot more romance of trains. You know, it's really just all trains this year, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I love trains too. I prefer traveling by train everywhere. 11 hours is my limit of pleasure I've discovered over the course of my life on a train. A train ride will be pleasurable for me for 11 hours. After that, it gets a little hairy. But you can get to a lot of places in 11 hours, even on Amtrak as it exists today.
All right. Well, let's carry on here. So at this point, nothing has really happened in this story. So we really are, as you said at the top, Brandon, due for some kind of obstacle or some kind of conflict. That is going to come now. It's going to come in the form of the railroad police. They find our characters while they are patrolling the train, but Nitty tries to talk them out of throwing them off the train. He succeeds, or at least seems to, but I want to pause the action here to make note of a few things. First, the two railroad police are women. Second, they tell Nitty to stop talking funny, and when Nitty speaks again, his speech is different. And up to this point, Wolf has been writing him in some kind of dialect, and now suddenly he is not. And we can't say much about this right now, but at the end, we'll understand what's going on here, and I think we will want to take this up in the discussion. I mean, we will need to take this up in discussion. But my favorite part about this conversation is that we do finally get this word that you have invoked already, Brandon. It's the word hobo, right? The railroad police here call our characters bows, which is short for hobo. So I'm just, you know, glad to have that word, you know, brought explicitly into the story.
Yeah, I love this whole section here. You know, Nitty has this kind of bowing and scraping energy that is communicated entirely through dialogue and dialect, as you've pointed out. But it's still clear he's running the show between him and Mr. Parker, but letting Mr. Parker act and think as though he's still in charge. And this is something that for some reason Nitty prioritizes. We'll understand why later. But for now, this moment where the railroad police, their names are Alice and Mickey, by the way, for people who are writing their thesis about Wolf's feelings about the Disney Corporation in the 1970s. But, you know, anyway, this moment where the railroad police tell Nitty he can stop talking funny is the particular scene I thought of when considering Wolf's leaning on Steinbeck's, you know, imagery of American imagery for this story. Something very much like this happens in East of Eden with a character called Mr. Lee. I don't think we need to go into that, but it's still helpful context for this story. The last thing I want to say here, I know I've interrupted the flow of the recap, but the last thing I want to say here is that we get a few reveals about Nitty and Mr. Parker's positions in the schools that they worked at. Nitty's job was building maintenance, which is basically like, you know, my dream job. But except in Nitty's case, building maintenance sounds a lot like skilled labor. And it is actually for in most cases, it really is skilled labor. But Nitty was doing like technical work as well, like taking care of the heating plant, servicing the teaching and cleaning machines, and doing electrical repair work more generally. So he really sounds like a highly skilled, like master electrician. And that's a big job. And on the other hand, Mr. Parker was just a figurehead. And he has a flashback where he recalls being fired. And his retort was this, I'll quote from the text, quote, "I will not leave this school until I am ready. I am in charge of the entire district." So I think we're meant to see a real contrast in the genuine social value or utility between Nitty and Mr. Parker.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of class going on here. We will see that there is more to it, you know, as we've been hinting at, but we'll save that revelation for when it actually shows up here in the story. Let's get back to the action here at this point. So part of Nitty's plea for the police to let them stay on the train until the next stop is that little Tib has become ill. He's suddenly become very pale. He's become hot, feverish, really, I guess. And so the police let them be with a promise to get off at the next stop. But it turns out that the police didn't mean it, that what they've really done is just leave the car and then throw a canister of tear gas back into it so that the three hobos will just throw themselves off the train to get away from this gas. But the canister doesn't go off. Or rather, it does go off, but it doesn't do anything, which is strange. That's not how they work. Also strange is that Mr. Parker is suddenly fine. His delusion is gone, and he's speaking with clarity and purpose and understanding, really for the first time since we've met him. And in fact, he describes the way he's been perceiving the world as some kind of dream. Also, little Tib is not feverish anymore, but he is really tired.
There's this moment in all the confusion of the gas being let out of the canister on the train where little Tib is suddenly on a hill above a creek and a strong west wind is blowing. Kite flying west wind is the term Wolf uses here. And these moments where little Tib can see are pretty important to what is going on in the narrative. On one hand, sight for the blind is a miracle. It's one of Jesus's miracles that he performed. So, you know, at this point, I think it's fair, to comb the text for miracles. I don't know if I have another hand here, so we'll just deal with that. But I haven't brought it up before, but this is maybe the first story of Wolf's that we've covered, Glenn, where all the work that you and I have put into approaching Wolf chronologically is paying just these huge dividends, much larger than I expected. I bring this up because of the way Wolf writes about the West Wind here. West Wind is also a story by Wolf, which is, you know, from one angle, a story about prayer to the Christian God and God's role as king, maybe, in our world. But I'm certain in that episode too, we talked about the cultural significance or the symbols of the West Wind, which is a wind that works in our favor. And so there are like many moments while reading the story where I felt really like a huge surge of gratitude for the nature of our approach to Wolf. And there's maybe even a bigger thematic concern within the Eye Flash Miracles that ties it closely to the Island of Dr. Death and other stories that we'll be able to talk about in our discussion. And maybe we can just put a pin on how this story is tied to Wolf's larger concerns for now and hone in on the idea of miracles. One way I think that we've seen Wolf approach miracles or the way he writes about them in this story is to show that there are ways of explaining miracles or that miracles can be explained through the use of larger discursive or epistemological considerations. So in the larger context of the society, and the way that Nitty, Mr. Parker, and Little Tib think about what they know about the world, there is a case to be made for the militarized train police force to have munitions that fail once in a while. There are always duds in munitions. This is probably true in an abstract sense. You know, and I'm saying that that wind carrying out all the gas or Little Tib's role in that is a kind of miraculous moment, aside from Little Tib having these moments of vision. But no one who lives in the practical circumstances where it is likely that they might be on the wrong side of a police baton or a gas canister lives in such a way that they can expect to encounter a dud. That would be foolish. It would be foolish to live in a way that the militarized police state is going to fail in their interactions with you. So what I'm trying to say here is that a miracle is present in the specific circumstances under which the munitions fail for these characters. In other words, I think miracles require a belief in a necessary universe that is unfolding towards a specific teleology. And the circumstances on this train for these characters could not have been otherwise. If they could have been otherwise, the argument goes, if it was necessary for the canister to be a dud, if that isn't even, you know, if that's even the explanation for what happened here, then there is a deeper purpose for this momentous occasion. And that deeper purpose, I think, is what is revealed in this miracle, even though epistemologically you could have an explanation for the canister being a dud and for that being happenstantial. Glenn, I don't know if I'm making sense here. I think I'm going too complicated here. I guess what I'm trying to do is uncover the way that Wolf is thinking about miracles in this story specifically and consider how that might form a template for how he uses them in his writing more generally, especially his writing after this story.
Right. Yeah. Well, and look, I mean, the story is called The Eye Flash Miracles. We've had a lot going on with, I think we got a sense right now of what the eye flash is, or at least eyes, right, as being important. But this is the first thing that looks like it might be a miracle. And of course, because this is, the first data point that we get like this. We, you know, we don't have a pattern yet, but you and I, of course, have read the entire novella before getting on to do these episodes. So we know that we are going to get more of them. So we can maybe stick a pin in that a little bit here and, you know, wait until we get the next installment in this and start to see, you know, what are the miracles here. And we have had miracles in Woolf's fiction before, you know, thinking here maybe of the Hour of Trust as one example that we might want to think about, because that also was a work of political science fiction from Woolf, also in this same short story collection. And of course, we will get them again. And this is actually probably a pretty important story as being a kind of bridge or kind of transition from the way that Woolf has been writing about miracles to a way that he's going to. But again, yeah, we'll be able to do more with that when we have the full catalog at our disposal. Well, it's time for another of Little Tib's dreams here. The boy is in a fantasy landscape and he can see. There's a talking cardinal. There's also a man who is made of copper. He's a wind-up person, really. He has winding keys on his back that will let him talk, let him move, also think. I mean, these are like distinct keys. He has multiple keys for these distinct functions. And there's some kind of booming sound around them, but Little Tib cannot see what's causing it because everything is shrouded in mist. But when he winds up the copper man's talking action key, the copper man's speech blows all the mist away, and it reveals a giant woman with a broom, and she's using that broom to chase away a rat. Little Tib recognizes this woman as his mother, but he doesn't get to talk to her because the copper man needs to look into Tib's eyes. But Tib wakes up from the dream at this point before that can happen.
The first thing that Little Tib encounters in this dream is a cardinal, like a bird, who blesses Tib under the sign of the cross with his wing. I'm not really sure that that matters here, but since Woolf is a fan of puns, it occurs to me that he might have had like the office of the cardinal in his mind. These are Catholic clergymen who are appointed by the Pope, often raised up from the bishopric, who have very high status in the Catholic Church, and they're often called upon. They're not often called upon. They are called upon to vote for a new pope when the time comes to do so. The other stuff going on here, though, is maybe a little more convoluted. The copper man that Tib runs into here is the TikTok man who appears in the Oz book by L. Frank Baum, Ozma of Oz. That's the third published Oz novel. And more or less, he appears in the Eyeflash Miracles exactly as he's described in Ozma of Oz. And my interpretation of a lot of the sensory information we get from Little Tib in this section can be explained by the way that the external world or the non-dream world is intruding upon Tib's dream here. But one thing I think we need to say is how this giant with the broom, which may be a reference to the giantess in a later Oz novel, is really a static memory of something from Tib's childhood. This giantess is his mother. Tib is probably very young and is revisiting this memory, or maybe this moment, which plays on a loop like a short GIF. I still don't know who won that battle, but this memory plays on a loop of his mother in the quote new place hitting a rat with a broom. So fine, but what's important is that we've already met Tib's mother, who is the king. So I think we have some real cause to be confused about this point in the story regarding who Tib's parents are, where he ran away from, and whether his mother is some ethereal king or a giantess kind of hitting a rat with a broom, you know, which maybe communicates something of a lower status in being. So a lower social status, maybe I should say, at least. So very confusing here, these two images of the mother. And the last thing I'll say here is that for the second time, now we learn that all Little Tib wants is to be known. It's what he hopes to learn from the TikTok man. It's what he thinks he can learn in the dreamland, and maybe why he wishes to stay there as well, and why he wants to go to Sugarland. So one way to consider Tib's motivation in the story, what's driving him forward as a character, is to think of this story as Tib asking the question, who am I? and going along until he finds the answers. But I don't know. Little Tib is still sleeping and he needs to see a doctor.
Yeah, he definitely does. We'll get to that in a second. But I just want to think here a little bit about these dreams that Tib is having, right? Where his parents are showing up and they're interwoven with elements of the fantastical. And, you know, we don't know what really has happened to Tib or his parents, why he's not with them. But we know that something happened. We know that he went blind at some point. And also we know that he is no longer with his parents. And it just seems to me that, you know, in these dreams that he's trying to make sense of all of that, and that possibly it's been quite a while since he's been with his parents, that perhaps he's having these dreams that are, you know, contain memories, images, imagistic memories of his parents that are getting interwoven with possibly, you know, the last or at least important books, right, that his parents read to him or read with him when he was younger, and that that's all gotten jumbled up together in his subconscious that's creating this kind of fantastical landscape there that he's trying to make sense of because he has grown and developed, begotten, you know, he's gotten older since the last time he saw them. And the world therefore is just different to him. And he can't really make sense of his memories here. Though I do think Wolf also is, you know, using these images to convey meaning about the story and so on. But I think he is, you know, doing both of these things in a way that's really quite clever.
It is really clever, and I cannot wait to kind of talk more at length about the way Wolf is returning to a kind of story that's very important to him, a story about not just symbolic networks that generate meaning and where we get them from, but about how young children use those to navigate confusing world that they're sometimes forced to navigate alone.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, even just you know, case in point, I won't give specifics here, but just this morning, family breakfast time, I mean, Finch, who's just four, quoted several different books that he and I read together all the time, just in conversation with Elizabeth, my wife, Finch's mom, right? Just around the breakfast table in ways that she didn't understand because she's not present for the reading of those books. But it's just real clear that like this is really important for him, that these books that he and I read together is a big part of how he makes sense of the world, to the extent that he quotes them in conversation, uses the lines, uses the phrases from these books to try to convey meaning to other people. Yeah. And of course, we all do that, right? I mean, this is a part of why you and I are, you know, have this podcast network where we talk about books. This is a thing we all do. But when you're a little kid, and the only way that you really experience the world is through reading, or maybe, you know, these stories are a much more significant way that a child experiences the world than adults do. And especially if a kid associates the act of experiencing stories, reading together as, you know, something is kind of loving activity, right? With his parents who are now suddenly gone, you can see where this would really blow up inside of a kid's subconscious in these dreams. I'm also, I guess, a person who spends a lot of time helping a little kid dealing with nightmares all night long and so on that, you know, I guess has me really thinking about, you know, what is going on in the minds of children, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my son does the same thing with his favorite. Well, he only watches one TV show called Masha and the Bear, and he has a sign language for his hand. He puts his hand a certain way that I know he's talking about Masha, and will out in the yard or on a walk or whatever in the world, he'll say, I recognize this thing. It's from Masha, and it's an invitation for me to engage, you know, deeper with him on something. But he's connecting, you know, his interests in the show or something he's shown on the show is being revealed to him in the world. And it's just, you know, he also has a ton of books too. He reads a lot, but his primary, story of meaning is Masha and the Bear. So it's so fascinating to see. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, you and I are pretty close to pulling back the curtain here and revealing that, in fact, for about 2 years now, we have really just been a Wine Dads podcast. But I'll get us back on track here, back to actually talking about the text. So we've got one more episode here to get through in this second recap episode. When Little Tib wakes up from this dream, he is in the doctor's office at the next town because he has slept for the rest of the train ride and even slept through being carried to the doctor's office. But he is awake now and he's burning up again. There is a family here with a little girl who has a deformed leg. She wears a brace to walk. And little Tib is interested in this. I mean, he can't see the brace, of course, right? And so he touches her leg in order to, sense this. And the girl is fine with this, though her mother is, she's just freaking out because Tib is dirty, right? But then, all of a sudden, the girl can walk again. I mean, her leg is healed. She's got a normal leg all of a sudden, and she is fine, just like Mr. Parker is fine now. It is a miracle, right? And as we've pointed out, that is the name of the story here. And Nitty casually asks if Tib understands what he's done, but he doesn't know anything about it. And anyway, it is time to see the doctor now. But of course, the doctors will not see Tib without being able to scan him, which they cannot do. Mr. Parker, though, has a plan. You see, he's ill himself, and he needs to see the doctor, but he also needs to take little Tib into the consultation room with him because Nitty can't stay with him in the waiting room. Nitty's got something else he's got to go do. Now, everyone knows this is a fiction, of course, but it allows them to fill out the paperwork, and then the doctor gives Mr. Parker some medicine that is really for little Tib. And besides this glimpse of the bureaucracy and the ways that people struggle to work around this bureaucracy, I want to draw our attention to two comments that I think we're going to want to bring to bear in the discussion episode. The first is that joblessness and the accompanying poverty is widespread here in America as the result of replacing workers with machines. But it's not only an American problem. This is a global problem. The other comment is something that Nitty says, and maybe I'll just read this. Here's what Nitty says. Why does a man feel so bad if he don't have real paying work to do? Also, I should say before we close out the recap for this episode that we now understand that what Mr. Parker is going to do when they get Tib to break into the building and unlock the door is use the computer in there to get his job back, also get Nitty his job back. And yeah, I guess that's a good place for us to break this episode, to break for today.
Yeah, I just want to say Mr. Parker is basically the worst cyberpunk protagonist like we've ever come across. You know, basically, that's what we've got here is the main plot of the story. While we're in Little Tib's point of view, we've stumbled upon a cyberpunk heist narrative where, you know, two characters are fed up with the corporate system or with the way that government's being in bed with private organizations like the Federal Reserve, combined with technological progress, have managed to completely obliterate the working class and maybe the middle class too, leaving the working class with no alternatives really. And Mr. Parker's ire isn't aimed at taking down the system. He just wants to tweak it in his favor. And it's a brilliant sort of twist on the typical motivations that you'd hope to find in this kind of resentment based motive. Like, rather than use injustice as fuel to change the system, Mr. Parker considers this whole business really just a misunderstanding and that he can tweak it so everything will be fine again. And we know that Mr. Parker and Nitty have tried and failed to accomplish this task before. And so little Tib falling in with this crew is really a piece of good fortune for Parker and Nitty. So Wolf is really a master of this sort of plotting where each character has clear motivations and people fall in and out with one another based on whether their motivations align at any given moment. And as alignments change, so does the direction of the story while the plot marches forward. Little Tib doesn't really have a plot action to do in this story. This plot is Mr. Parker's plot. And so it's great. What a great way to tell the story. But it's hilarious that we're getting this like, I just want my job back, cyberpunk kind of storytelling.
Right. It's not actually the cyberpunk that we get circa 1990 for sure, but I would definitely watch a film adaptation of this movie in which Johnny Lee Miller plays Mr. Parker and yeah, Angelina Jolie plays Nitty. Like middle-aged version, versions of yeah, these actors 30 years after Hackers. I would be all about that.
Hackers 2, and it takes place for some reason in the far future with the same cast. That would be a movie I'd watch. I'm also really glad you brought up this bit about the bureaucracy, because I think Wolf is looking at large systems and institutions and their role in our current contemporary civilization here. that's something we'll definitely be taking up in our discussion. So I think I can just mark it here and let it be something we engage with in our 6-hour discussion episode or whatever we end up with. But for now, I want to again highlight this miracle. We have the intrusion of the dream world, the sound of the broom trying to hit the rat again, and the growth of this little girl's leg as little Tib imagines walking to Oz. And then we also get this question of whether he was involved with the miracle at all. And in this case, I think, though, there's less here to explain how the girl's leg was healed than, you know, there's less explanatory power in, you know, like an episteme or something like that, or a popular mode of discourse to explain the healing than there was in explaining a dud munition or a head injury, like Mr. Parker's head injury being healed by some form of percussive maintenance, you know. And so what I will say for now is that Tib is taking something that is deficient in some way as compared to a norm and making it whole, right? He's taking something broken and restoring it. And yet he is unable to heal himself. And maybe we'll see why that is, or what sort of sight it is that Tib has as we continue in our recap episodes. So on that note, that is going to do it for our second recap of the iFlash Miracles. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. Please do also check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia, so you can get access to, well, almost 200 episodes at this point, bonus episodes at this point, but also my Thousand Worlds series. I've just released the second installment of that chronological journey through George R. Martin's Thousand Worlds stories this month, so you're just in time to get access to that. Next time here, we will be back with part 3 of our recap. We're going to be covering up to page 310. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.